Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
The rich man's activity of choice is now to blast himself off of this planet and orbit space. Again, a very energy, you know, used to race yachts, and that was fairly energy efficient. You harness the wind. But now, you know, if you're a millionaire and a billionaire, you want to shoot, you aspire to shoot yourself into space. So that just goes to show you how cheap energy really has been.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this special edition of Finance University. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and today we're going to be talking once again with Adam Rosenzweig of Gehring and Rosenzweig Natural Resource Investors. We're going to be talking about some really important stuff, including their amazing call on platinum, peak oil, uranium, silver, too. I think we got to get to all of this because it is probably the time of natural resources. It's still early, but it's time to get into them, I think. Adam, welcome to the show.
Great to see you again. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm just going to dive right in. All this great stuff you put out. Again, your quarterly reports are just absolute must reads for me, I think everybody. In this most recent one, talking about the hidden revival of platinum and palladium, I just want to point out that this came out on May 22nd. So I've taken the opportunity of putting that on the chart. Boy, there's good timing and then there's great timing. Look at that explosion, 35% increase in, well, 50 at one point in platinum there. Let's talk about how you made this call. And some of your commentary said, quote, in our experience, when broad swaths of an extractive industry begin operating with negative cash margins, speculators find it increasingly difficult to push prices lower. Take people through that. And fundamentals do matter, correct?
I think they absolutely do. I mean, look, you know, I've had a lot of long days and sleepless nights. And if I wasn't working on the assumption that at some point the fundamentals made a difference, then I probably would have given this up a long, long time ago. So sometimes it takes an awfully long time for the fundamentals to be properly recognized. But eventually, we're certainly of the opinion that fundamentals do rule the day. Now, you know, you were kind enough to mention our wonderful timing. You know, better to be lucky than right sometimes. And in terms of, you know, our timing is never our strong suit. And in fact, we put on most of those positions sort of in the third and fourth quarter of last year and, you know, suffered through kind of 6-9 months of, you know, relatively middling returns in our PGM book in particular. And then we decided that we were going to write about the PGMs, and Lee actually turned to me and he said, you know, we better really rush this out because it feels like this market is about to move a lot higher. And so we actually kind of did rush that letter out by a couple of weeks to make sure we were out in print. And sure enough, he was right on that. So, you know, we were, our views are not usually so precise on the timing. And in fact, our investment decision here was early, just like we typically are. But the letter did come out in very good time. So, you know, one of the things that we've noticed, we love, for whatever reason, to get involved in these really out of favor contrarian sectors. Obviously, we think that's where there's value to be had. And certainly in retrospect, when one works, you can look back after you've done it a few times, you say, oh my goodness, there certainly was a huge amount of latent value pent up in those stocks and in that space. And this was no different. You know, in many cases, the PGM stocks were getting so cheap that, you know, some value investor, I remember, wrote a report that said you could buy these stocks at their lows for less than the value of the scrap steel in the mills. And I don't think that we were able to quite get there at our valuation, but it was awfully close. You're basically being given the mines for almost nothing. And then the commodity price itself seemed really cheap and still does, frankly. And what we like to look at there, obviously, there's kind of two sides to it. First is platinum and palladium. Platinum, let's focus on that, often trades in a relationship to gold. They're kind of considered both in a precious metal basket. And it was not uncommon in past cycles, just given how rare platinum is, that platinum, you know, would trade at a big premium to gold. And certainly, you know, the Amex Platinum card is more exclusive than the Amex Gold card, et cetera. And $1,000 premium, you know, was not unheard of in that space. And then you all of a sudden got it down to a more than $1,000 discount. So you were just at a really, really wide dislocation, at least relative to gold and certainly relative to other things. The other area that we like to look at is you say, okay, look, how's the industry doing? You know, is the commodity price such that the producers in the industry are making good money and then they're able to reinvest that profitably into expansions and growth and stuff like that? I mean, that tells you that the commodity price is at least where it needs to be, if not a little bit in excess. Or you get to other points, and we can talk back, you know, uranium at $18 a pound, oil at $20, $30, I would argue oil even at $50 a pound, gold at $1,500 a couple years ago. You know, the average cash cost of the gold industry was pushing $1,500. The average full cycle cost on an oil well was in excess of $60 or $70, and you got the price down to, you know, $30. Those are unsustainable levels. You know, in uranium, you had one producing uranium company in the world. That was Cameco at the time, because Kazatomprom had not yet listed. Their cash costs were like $25 and the spot price was $18. The price is too low. You know, you don't need to be have a PhD in mineral economy, which is a thing, mineral economics, to understand that if the entire industry can't make any money, then either the industry goes away or the price goes higher. So when you can buy assets where the commodity price is unsustainably low and the stocks are underwriting that low price, and you're getting the asset basically for free, you know, you all of a sudden start to tilt the odds in your favor. And that's what we saw with the PGM space.
Now, speaking of, so these are sort of narrative structures that are out of whack. There's a couple of moving parts, right? So A, you have the speculators dominate a lot of these markets, right? They are the market. CTAs, I think, are 70% of the oil market. They never take a barrel. They never produce a barrel, but they're trading the majority of the product. So as long as there's a buffer there for them to eat into, they can keep that up for a little longer than you would think. But then the producers end up squealing, and we're getting those sounds all over the space. So I just want to talk about that in my favorite area. So I went down to this as one contrarian indicator. I go to this Limitless conference, Ken McElroy and Tarl Yarbrough's thing. There's 1,000 people there. I think 26 people showed up to my talk, you know. And the one
that's a great sign.
Yes. And of the ones who did, they all went wink because, you know, what I said was, you know, we get headlines like this, right, which just came out on July 31st. U.S. oil output rose to a record in May. That's this. People are consuming these headlines and they say, oh, look down there. U.S. crude output was up 24,000 barrels per day in May from the prior record of 13.46 in April, which was the previous record. So you just hear record after record after record. But the context is, wait a minute, the headline for the earlier report, March report, was U.S. March production at new high, but they revised that back down by 35,000 barrels so they could beat the new record. This sounds like the beat by a penny stuff I have to put up with. And this is by Ovi over at Peak Oil Barrel. Great stuff. This is the reality. I told people, I'm like, listen, you know, this is an investor conference. Crude oil has been just in a sustained 2-year downtrend. The XLE has gone nowhere, dead money 3 years, right? But I know this is what I want to get your take on. I mean, here it is. It's not just some guys on the internet. It's the EIA in April comes out with their annual energy outlook, and they put this chart in there, and I've helpfully annotated it in case anybody missed the concept. Dude, that's a peak.
Yeah, and you know that chart was probably the most important, I would say, chart that no one watched or no one noticed this year so far, because I don't know if you have last year's chart, but last year's chart basically showed growth forever.
It was till 2050
for sure. Till 2050.
Yeah.
And instead of 2050 in 12 months, they said, no, actually, it's going to be next year. And I mean, that's a major, major shift. Even, you know, I would have expected maybe they would have taken it from 2050 to 2040 to 2030, but it went from 2050, which is effectively, as far as anyone's concerned, never, to tomorrow. And that's a huge, huge difference. You know, I get a lot of flack and pushback from people that say, oh, you called for peak oil and here we're getting new records. And, you know, first of all, I say, look, I do admire a lot of the work of originally King Hubbert and then all of his disciples, including John Le Herrer, who still publishes from time to time. And he worked with Hubbert directly. But we're not necessarily, you know, first of all, peak oil has been so discredited because the shales have come along. And I think that's complete nonsense, because what the shales did, they were a complete separate system. They were a new oil resource laid on top of conventional. The conventional stuff has followed the peak trajectories just fine. The shales, frankly, have followed a peak oil type trajectory very, very closely as well. And we have said for years now, since 2019, we said we expect that non-OPEC oil growth from the shales will begin to slow. We used to grow 1.5 million barrels a day. Those days are over. We are now going to slow. And that's exactly what has happened ever since. And furthermore, we said we expect 2024, 2025, it'll roll over. And, you know, by most of the numbers that I look at, whether I look at the shale data, which, remember, shale's 95% of all the growth that we've had, that peaked out in November of last year. Now, you're right, they revised some of the data. So sometimes it's October, sometimes it jumps out to January. Was it late 24, early 25? I don't know. We're not growing. You know, that is for sure and certain. You look at the year-on-year figures, which in some ways are important, in some years are meaningless. Everyone likes to look at the year-on-year numbers, but there's not huge seasonality in oil production. So you can look at the sequential data, but on a year-on-year basis, you peaked out in 2019 at 1.5 million, 1.6 million. You've been going down and down and down. You're now at 150,000 barrels a day. So whether it crosses this month or next month or 5 months from now on a year-on-year basis, frankly, makes absolutely no difference. This is all happening. It's happening in a very orderly way, and people are just fighting it tooth and nail. And you're right, absolutely no one has any interest in the oil markets. And I think that's going to change very soon.
Yeah, that's probably why I titled my, this is what I, biggest untold story. And it remains untold, mostly, except a very small audience. But this chart is the biggie. And they put some other helpful charts in here, which basically just shows it where it's flattening out by shale plays. And really, it's really a tale of the Permian, as we've talked about. Actually, I think we're down to two counties, Lee and Eddy County. I mean, that's like the whole story of the miracles that Reuters is writing about rely on two counties. Most people don't know that. And they're both starting to gas out, which is a sign of maturity, not early stage, you know, exploitation.
Well, that's an interesting point, too. And actually, I'm due to do a little bit of work on that, because the story. So you're right. You know, the shale story has just gotten narrower and narrower and narrower. And some people might say, OK, who cares? But that's really a telltale sign of resource depletion. When you're operating in a very healthy environment, you have lots of different contributors that are all growing, a new field pops up. I mean, just think about when the shales first came online. You know, first it was on the gas side, it was the Barnett. That's where George Mitchell cracked the code, if you will. Then it moved on to the Fayetteville. Then before you knew it, you were starting to drill up in Pennsylvania and the Marcellus and then the Haynesville. And it was like every day there was a new basin that was opening up and opening up and opening up. The same on the oil side. You know, they tried to bring that technology to the Bakken. You know, people might not remember, it goes back probably 20 years, but the Bakken was technically not a shale because it had all these interbedded layers. So they said, fine, this could actually work, but probably won't work anywhere else. Then the Eagle Ford and the Permian, one after the other. You just seem to be leaning into this growth. And then that begins to kind of work back the other way. And so all of a sudden, you're fully delineated. You then start developing it out. Then your best areas start to fall away. You have one fewer, and the whole thing narrows and narrows and narrows. So I remember 2 or 3 years ago, we said, you're down to six counties in West Texas. That's basically propping up the entire non-OPEC world. Now you're down to two counties. Some people might say, well, who cares? But I mean, that's depletion. Depletion is not a textbook definition. It's you know it when you see it, and it's this narrowing of the supply base. It's this narrowing of the sources of new growth that are coming online. And so that's certainly happening, as you mentioned. Now, the other thing that you brought up was a really interesting point, and it's one that people have debated and pontificated on for a number of years. That's how gassy the shales are actually getting. And that's a really subtle question, because in theory, in principle, when you have what is known as a tight mixed medium reservoir, so I won't get too technical, but basically you don't have lots of permeability and porosity, and you have both oil, gas, and condensate, you have the whole spectrum of hydrocarbons. What ends up happening in theory and in practice, when you lower the reservoir pressure to a certain point, you actually begin to separate the gas from the liquid. So what happens, imagine you think of a bottle of soda. When it's sealed, it's under high pressure. There's gas on top of the liquid, but there's lots of gas embedded, obviously, in the soda itself. You release the pressure, and all of a sudden, the gas begins to separate out from the liquid, right? And that's your bubbles coming to the top. That's what's happening downhole. And for the beginning part of the life of a field, you're keeping it under pressure. You're keeping that soda bottle sealed. And so all that gas charges up the liquid, and it helps it flow up the wellbore. When eventually it separates, what finally happens is you get this whoosh of gas, because the gas flows preferentially up the wellbore, and it leaves the dead oil behind. So your gas to oil ratios explode to the upside than an individual well. And that's almost like the swan song of that mixed medium field, because what it's telling you is you're running out of pressure. So there have been a couple of gas scares. People call it retrograde condensate. People call it the bubble point. The gas oil ratio is what you measure. There's been a couple of scares in the Permian in the past, mm-hmm. where people have thought that this was going to happen. And it turns out in retrospect, you were seeing different things. So for instance, the Permian is quite a diverse, heterogeneous field. There's areas that are naturally gassier than others. So just by moving a few rigs from here to there, you can get a major change in your gas oil ratio. You're not seeing this massive death of the Permian. What you're seeing is people moving over mostly more into the Delaware. So I've been a little bit skeptical in the past. You know, if you look like for like, if you look at a series of wells in a very predefined area and you say, are they getting gassier? I haven't really seen that. And we're doing some work now to see whether this time is a little bit different, or is this another kind of false alarm? But you are seeing a bigger gas oil ratio in the Permian. It's what's propping up gas supply better than oil supply, even though it's all coming from the same place. By definition, it means you're getting more gas for unit of oil. Could it be the end? It could be. I'm not ready to make that claim quite yet.
The markets are unraveling and the stakes could not be higher. If you're relying on passive strategies or so-called diversification, or perhaps using an advisor who was, I don't know, maybe in elementary school during the great financial crisis, you could be on a collision course with staggering portfolio losses. Peak Financial Investing is your lifeline. We handpick wealth managers who will actively manage your portfolio with proven, market-savvy strategies, not the tired modern portfolio theory that could crumble under pressure. The unprepared will not just lose this time, but lose big. The future that I see consists of both winners and losers, but many more losers this time than last time. Go to peakfinancialinvesting.com today and schedule your free consultation. This is your chance to protect your wealth. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. And I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, urging you, please don't wait another day. So you mentioned in the depletion paradox that green part, that's conventional, aka cheap oil, right? That we see that peak right over there in right around 1970-ish, right? 71.
Yep.
And drill rigs exploded, prices exploded, everything exploded. And what happened? Well, nothing. There were no more conventional came out of the ground. But then this tight oil came along, you know? And when we have to look at it separately, so Art Berman does a great job drawing this. And then speaking of drawing, I just took, using a shaky mouse hand, I just sort of extrapolated, you know, what it might look like if we peak now, you know? And it just goes, that's what it's going to look like. I don't think anybody's ready for this. I don't have any sense that Trump or the Trump administration, I thought Chris Wright would know this, but he probably does. But Trump just seems to think that 65 is too much for oil and he wants more to come out of the ground anyway. This is me literally taking half the area on the left and making it on the right with a little extra. That, with my mouse again, nothing magic, but it's just to illustrate the point that that's a very different future on the downslope of that than on the upslope. And I don't think we're ready for that as a nation, narrative-wise, let alone from an investment standpoint.
No, I don't think we are either. And look, you know, the United States wasn't ready for it in 1971 either. And, you know, frankly, it gets so muddied with all different factors, including housing and the GFC and China and whatever. But the same thing happened in 2003 to 2005, you know, where the major growth was in the North Sea and Cantarell. And both of those exhibited the same chart. So, no, I don't think that we were ready in 71. I don't think we were ready in 2003. I don't think we're ready now. I don't think it means that the world's going to come to an end. I do think that sometimes the peak oil crowd, which I think get a very bad name. I think they do a lot of very, very good, robust science. But sometimes in some of those message boards, it can take a little bit of a Malthusian twist. It can take a little bit of a sort of doom and gloom twist. And look, you know, 2003 to 2010, we had some very severe recessions and economic hardships and turmoil, but we didn't go back to living on a subsistence agrarian lifestyle or anything. We're going to make do. We're going to find ways through it. But I think we do it through pain and a lot higher prices, just like we did through the 70s. You know, the world didn't stop turning in the 1970s, but oil stocks were fantastic investments, and it became very difficult to outpace inflation in other parts of the market. So I think that, you know, that chart looks a little bit scary, and I think it should look a little bit scary, because we're in this phase where the big growth driver is showing signs of stalling, and that's never been anything but a predictor of higher prices in energy.
Well, the way I look at it, which some could interpret as Malthusian, just when you're on the upslope of oil production, things are easier. And then when you're on the downslope, things just get generally harder, right?
Absolutely. That's a very good way of putting it. You know, things get much, much more difficult and challenged. It's no different. You know, energy, I believe, is the lifeblood, which I know you do as well, of the economy. I think that really economic output and GDP is just energy in a different set of units. Mm-hmm. But it's the same as running, you know, easy money or tight money, right? If you start to constrict the money supply dramatically, everything becomes really hard. And it's the same thing with energy. If you start to make the lifeblood of economic growth that much more precious, it means that things become, on the margin, more difficult. You have to be more efficient. I don't mean more efficient, you know, energy efficient, although I guess I do mean that, but you just have, the whole system has to run more efficiently because you don't have this tailwind of easy, excess, stable energy. And I mean, look, just look at the last 10 years. It's amazing how people get lulled into an era of cheap, abundant energy. You know, we conducted massive, massive investments in the most energy intensive activities known to man. You know, we built out huge wind and solar farms in an attempt to try to curb global warming. That was hugely energy intensive, right? We've talked about this energy in, energy out, huge energy in, very modest energy out. So we went down that path. Why didn't we do that 10 or 15 years before? I mean, the first windmills, you know, have been around for, you know, 1,000 years. Well, why did windmills take off in 2010 to 2020? Because the energy feedstock to go into them was extremely cheap in historical terms. No new major new technologies broke out, particularly in wind. You know, what did we do on the technology front? We built very power-hungry cryptocurrency networks and eventually machine learning and AI, which are just massive power hogs. I'm not dismissing the benefit of AI, but I don't think that that would have happened in the 1970s, which, mind you, all the underlying, you know, software algorithms of perceptrons and MLPs and whatever, they were all out and about in the 1970s, but no one really gave them much thought because semiconductors weren't there and because they were so power intensive. And then finally, not to knock on, you know, the hyperscalers of the day, but, you know, the rich man's activity of choice is now to blast himself off of this planet and orbit space. Again, a very energy, you know, you used to race yachts and that was fairly energy efficient. You harness the wind, but now, you know, if you're a millionaire and a billionaire, you want to shoot you aspire to shoot yourself into space. So that just goes to show you how cheap energy really has been.
Yeah, well, it has been. And by the way, I didn't pull the chart up for this. I should have, but I ran across this Wood Mackenzie analysis that said, for speaking about natural gas, speaking about AI for a second, speaking about this, which again, predictions are very difficult to make, especially about the future. As Yogi Berra said, this was also in that annual energy outlook. And they said, look, crude oil and least condensate, but also natural gas plant liquids, kind of flat. There's another chart that showed total energy production for the U.S. kind of flat. But Adam, I'm looking at AI data centers are going in exponentially, right? And we have enormous LNG exports, which are contractually obligated, bunch of, you know, LNG trains, blah, blah. Wood Mackenzie said, oh, we're going to have 43 billion cubic feet per day more production demand, supply demands, by 2035. That's a 40-ish percent increase from where we are today.
Right.
Do you have any concerns about us achieving that?
Of course, I have huge concerns. You know, if you talk to anybody, maybe with the exception of some of the data center providers and hyperscalers, who I've, frankly, I don't speak to them on a regular basis, but when you look at the MLPs, when you look at the LNG export terminals, when you look at just general utilities, none of them are worried. None of them. They're worried about being able to secure supply. You know, there's many things that they worry about. They worry about financing. They worry about, you know, whether the equity window is open, whether the cost of capital arbitrage exists. But when you ask them about the ability to secure supply, they say, no, that's the one thing we don't have to worry about, because look, I've stress tested my models to 450 gas. And if you got 450 gas, you'd be able to all of a sudden bring on so much more production that we'd be totally fine. And so, you know, then I really wanted to make sure. So I stress tested it to $5 gas, and then, you know, we're good. You say, yeah, that's all well and good, but the global price for gas is like $14 landed, $11 kind of net back to the net back to the Gulf Coast. You know, what if it goes to 11? And they're like, well, that can't happen. And that's the answer you get over and over again. It can't happen. And I disagree with that vehemently. I think it certainly can happen once you start to embed all this domestic demand. And, you know, what it means is that if you open up, even in theory, a single molecule of excess capacity in the export terminal, then you lock the U.S. price to the world price, right? The reason the world price right now is so dislocated from the world price is that even though we export a lot, there's still too much gas here. So if you have sit with a well in Pennsylvania, you cannot access the world price. Once you have excess capacity, even in theory, just a single molecule's worth on one of those export terminals, you in theory can access the world price, and arbitrage would bring those two prices together, right? Mm. And so if you start to embed all this domestic demand, whether it's new LNG, whether it's domestic data center demand, what have you, at the same time as production is flat, or as we think rolling over, you'll pin those two prices together. And that likely means a much higher gas price than anyone is contemplating. And I'll give you a really interesting kind of anecdotal example, right? You know, if you go back to the history of LNG in the United States, at least modern LNG, because there was some before this, but modern LNG industry in the United States kind of starts with Cheniere and Suki Sharif back in 2003 to 2007. And over that time frame, he was a very interesting, eclectic man, very, very smart visionary, has a wild, eclectic background before he got into the energy industry. But he saw this dislocation in world gas markets, where he felt that there'd be too much LNG coming from Qatar, and the United States was the only country in the world with huge storage to be able to import it. So that the idea would be that we would import, when gas prices effectively went to zero on a global basis, we would import this gas, put it into our salt caverns, which don't really exist in other parts of the world, and then deliver that to meet U.S. domestic demand in the wintertime, where gas prices were really high, and he thought he'd make a fortune doing this, so he built Cheniere. The only problem was, and I don't blame him at all, but it failed to account for the shales that were about to be developed, right? So 10 years on, the shales were humming. We had more gas than we knew what to do with, and so Sharif turned that import terminal into the first export terminal. And in doing that, it was a very challenging process, as you might imagine, near bankruptcy a few times. And he paid himself a massive equity options package. So the deal was kind of like an Elon Musk deal. You know, he took a big hunk of deep out of the money call options and took no compensation. I don't know, no, but de minimis, the vast, vast majority of his compensation was marked to market in these out of the money call options. And they hit. He delivered the project and the stock was a screamer and he made a huge amount of money. And I forget what the number was, but in a given year, when they eventually fired him for having made too much money, you know, he was the highest paid CEO in the States. And he left or was forced out, and he started a new company. I'm sorry, it's a long story, but I think it has an interesting punchline.
Great story.
So he started a new company, and that new company was called Tellurian. And Tellurian's idea was that he was going to build the next LNG export terminal. Cheniere was still doing its thing. He wasn't involved. Now he was going to do it all over again. However, he was going to do take all the lessons that he learned from Cheniere and do it the right way this time. And so what were some of those lessons? Well, the first is he said, I'm not going to do debt anymore. I'm going to focus on equity. Yes, it's going to be more dilutive, but it's too volatile of a business, too cyclical of a business. When you put debt into the mix, you run the risk of an asymmetric downside case, wiping your equity out. So we're going to suffer the dilution. It'll be my money along with everyone else's. And we're going to do equity. The second thing that he said, and this is where I want to focus because I think it's so fascinating. He said, I want to own the upstream asset. I never want to find myself in a situation where we don't have access to the gas or where the gas price is $11. You know, he goes, as long as I can produce gas for $2, $3, what have you, and have enough to feed into my LNG export terminal, that's how I want to control my destiny. I never want to be beholden on a domestic gas price that could spike against me. So he did that and he advanced Tellurian, and the equity dilution eventually got them. And yeah, there's a period of time where they needed to do a deal and the markets were tough, and they eventually forced him out of that. And the first thing that they did was they sold the upstream Haynesville asset. So I think in this entire cycle, when we look back, the only person that will have gotten that part of the story right, it's not the MLP executives, it's not the LNG executives, and hyperscalers, I'll give them a pass because I haven't spoken to them, but who it was Suki Sharif at Tellurian understood that you want to own that asset on the upstream. And what did they do? They got rid of him and they sold the asset.
Wow.
So no one cares.
Wow, no one cares. I mean, yeah, so you read, I mean, you get your Doombergs, and they all say, oh, but Chris, come on, Adam, there's 700 trillion cubic feet of reserves. We're only pulling out, you know, a few of those per year. There's 135 years or whatever the numbers actually add up to. But every time I look into the actual studies, I see that, you know, a lot of the associated gas came out of the Permian. It just came along for the ride. They weren't drilling for it. It was just part of the package going after the oil. But there's gas there, too, so that's part of it. But I'm starting to see that you know, we can begin to see the end of the tier one acreage in the Marcellus, which we talked about last time. There's two big quadrants, right? Southeast, north, northwest, or whatever. Maybe I had that backwards. Southwest and northeast. There were two areas.
Northeast and southwest. Yeah.
Yes, two big areas in there. Any updates on that? Does that still seem to track, or is there anything new to add?
No, it certainly still seems to be tracking. You know, the one caveat that I would give is that I think the latest monthly data point that came out showed a little bit of an uptick in production that was preceded by a bit of a downtick, more aggressive downtick in production. Was it April, May, or March, April? I can't remember right now. You know, the monthly data has a tendency to be both revised and noisy in and of itself. So, you know, for those that follow it very, very, very closely, I don't want to get nasty emails saying last month was good. Last month did seem to have a resurgence. I would need to see a couple months, you know, before I started to need to change my opinion on what's happening there. The individual well productivity coming out of the Marcellus has been in a very sustained downtrend for the last 3 years. So if I look at, you know, initial production or 12, 24, 36 month cumulative production per lateral foot, adjusting for how long the wells are, those have been flat to deteriorating now for 3 years, and production's been flat for 3 years. So in a field that really drove growth in the U.S., production really hasn't changed in 36 months. That's quite remarkable. Now, the industry would tell you that it's pipeline constraints and pricing and stuff like that. But, you know, I don't know. That's what the industry always tells you. The point is, I think, when you start to look at you take an assessment of what you believe the total recoverable reserves in that field are, and you begin to then look at where fields roll over. And shale's a little bit different than conventional. Conventional, it's around 50%. Shale, it's actually closer to 35 or 38% they roll over. And it's because they have those long tails. So if you think about it, it rolls over earlier, right? You have this long, sustained tail. That's fine. But maximum production is somewhere in the 35 to 40% range of total recoverable reserves produced. And, you know, you could make the case as early as 2019 that growth in a lot of these areas were done and that the Permian would stop growing in 24. 24, and that the Marcellus would stop growing. I forget when we had it at maybe 22, and that's what's happened. You know, so again, you say, you talk about making predictions about the future, and Buffett said once, which is so remarkable, he said, you know, in investing, it's hard to even look back and say, did you get that decision wrong? You know, you say, what's the risk of an investment before you make it? Say, I don't know. What's the risk as it's happening? I don't know. Then it works out a certain way. You say, well, what was the risk in retrospect? Like, I still don't really know. You know, it's a very, very philosophical, abstract kind of a concept here. But when you can look at point T time and say, I expect in 3 years that production's going to stagnate, and then in 3 years production does stagnate, that leads you to believe that perhaps your model's in the right direction. Then you keep calibrating as it goes. It's easy to look back and say, why is this happening, and put what you think are intuitive explanations. Much harder to make predictions going forward. And when you land on a model or a framework or whatever that seems to be predictive, I think you should let that inform your gut and inform your decisions, because that's the best you can do. So it's a long way of saying, back about 5 years ago, we expected right around now we would start to see massive degradations in both per well productivity, followed by slowing in growth, and then ultimately rolling over in production. And we're seeing all of those. And until I see a deviation from that trend, I'm going to go with the models that have gotten us to where we are today. And so I think that means the production is going to roll over awfully soon, whether it's this month, this quarter, or even this year. I don't know. But it's going to happen very, very, very soon. And no one has it priced in. That's the important part.
Yeah. And you know, to me, it's so I'm an investor at the individual well level. And so I'm pretty tight with the economics. They're not that hard. You know, you put money into a hole in the ground and money comes back out. And you have to figure out how to divvy it up. So, and there's not that many divvies.
That's the hardest part.
Yeah.
So, the divvying it up and calculating what you actually own is, I think, the hardest part of the whole thing.
Yeah. You know, it gets down to like four decimals of percentages, right? It gets very precise over time. But, you know, to me, this is just a rig count, the Baker's Hughes rig count. It's really falling. And there's a second subtle piece that sits under this for me, which is the DUC, the drilled but uncompleted, the DUCs. Those went from about, what were we at, 4,000 or 5,000 of those, and we're down under 1,000 right now. And I have a question about those. How many of those haven't been completed because they're dogs and they'll never be completed? So I'm sure there's some dog meat in that residual duck pile, but I'll ask you about that. But this tells me that we're going to see a future fall off in production, and that's just how it has to be, because the only way this could not do that is if well productivity was, or per rig productivity was, screaming higher, and it's just not. That's what I see.
No, it's not. No, it's not. So a couple things that you're talking about there, which I agree with pretty much everything that you're saying, if not everything. You know, the first thing is, like you said, the rig count's falling and you're not seeing an uptick in per well productivity. So the other part that some people miss, and this actually is improving, it's not enough to balance the math though, but it is something that I see a lot of people leave out, and that's the time element. So it's how many wells does a rig drill in a given period of time, right? So if you think it's number of rigs times how many wells it rigs times drills times how productive each well is. So the time to drill has actually gotten a bit better. So that's working in the favor, but it's not enough to overcome the decrease in the well rig count, nor is it enough to overcome the combined decrease in rig count and per well productivity. So no, you're drilling fewer wells and they're less productive. That does not bode well for growth. The second thing that you mentioned was the DUCs. And yeah, we saw a massive drawdown in DUC inventory last year. And I suspect some level of those DUCs that remain are quite poor. That's actually a good study. We could easily look at that with our neural network. We can identify the wells that have been drilled but uncompleted, and just take a estimate of the productivity of those wells vis-a-vis the ones in their surrounding areas. And next time I'll come back with an answer to that question. How Great. About that? Because that's a fascinating one. But you know, the guy Connors, who writes, you know, the Crude Chronicles, which is a very good Substack that I quite like, he framed it, I think, very nicely, where he said, you know, you look at all these different buffers in oil supply and you're blown through all of them. So the easiest buffer to understand, obviously, is the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, you know, and that's half gone. The next is the drilled but uncompleted wells. Those are 85% gone. And then the last one is the OPEC overhang, and that's being whittled into. And, you know, you've never hit zero on all those things, right? And I don't suspect we'll hit zero this time either. But when you start to draw down these buffers, what you do is you lead to a tighter overall market. And the oil market's a little bit different than any other market in the world, because you mentioned the CTAs. Absolutely. You know, they're, you know, 90%, 70% of the trading volume, whatever, 90% on any given day. However, the oil market still is a massive 105 million barrel a day physical market, and you need to set a price every day to bring 105 million barrels of supply and 105 million barrels of demand together and clear that transaction. And so it is rooted in a massive, physical, important, your life-altering trade. And so it is grounded somewhere in a little bit of reality. It doesn't mean that the price can't deviate hugely off of that. But my point is that when you tighten everything and you take out all these guardrails from the system, first in the form of the SPR, second in the form of the DUCs, third in the form of OPEC spare capacity, what you're doing is you're making the backdrop for a very, very tight market that can that could potentially really run on you. And that, I think, is with what's happening today. You know, global OECD inventories, they're low. They haven't been drawing. They've been kind of flat for 2 years. I would argue that the market has been basically flat, basically balanced. But it's balanced at a very tight level, so you don't have these protections anymore and these buffers.
Yeah, this has to be pool number four in your list, which is just inventories, right? We have them.
Exactly.
And there we are at the bottom of the five-year range, which would be the blue wedge, right?
Yeah.
There's 7.6 gigabarrels in storage. I mean, that's a lot. 7.6 billion barrels sounds like a lot, but it's at the bottom end of our working inventory. And same thing for the U.S. We're not out, but we're kind of bouncing along the bottom, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I don't see what your time scale is there on the bottom of the 2020.
Starts at 2020 and goes through 2026, so it's projecting forward. Again, this is from that yearly outlook. This is the short-term energy outlook from July.
Yeah, so I mean, you see that, you know, during COVID we built up obviously these huge inventories. We drew them down through the third quarter of 22. I think we've basically been balanced since the end of 22 to today, right? So the inventories have kind of just flatlined since then. It tells me we're in a balanced market at a low level. And that's a vulnerable position to be in, particularly as demand is holding in quite well and as production is beginning to slow in all these different areas. And like you said, we've taken out a lot of these buffers, inventories of either just straight crude or DUCs, which is effectively, you know, crude once you complete them, or spare capacity in the OPEC world. So I think it's a very, very, very tight market going forward for the next 9, 12, 15 months. And nobody has that in their models. You know, no one has any interest in the space. Oil prices in real dollars, oil prices relative to gold, oil prices, even in nominal dollars, they're quite middling. In real dollars relative to gold, they're almost at all-time lows. And when you look at that historically, where you get these, what they seem to be these capitulation lows, you understand why inventory surge, production surging, the market is in clear surplus. Today, the market's like balanced, you know, for the time being balanced, and you're getting a price that's telling you you're in the worst bear market that we've seen, and the fundamentals and the price just don't line up.
Well, not to fear, the IEA will come out and say peak oil demand is happening today or tomorrow. And so we'll go with that. But hey, I'd like to get... you had a really surprising piece in this most recent quarterly update, and I think a lot of people are trying to make this decision right now. I'd love to bring this to our listeners here. You said the efficiency gains for hybrids, comparing an ICE, an internal combustion engine vehicle, to a pure electric vehicle with a hybrid spanning the two. You said that the efficiency gains for those hybrids border on the scandalous. All told, if one begins again with that same 100 kilowatt hours of primary energy, wherever that comes from, the hybrid will carry its occupants 56 miles, 40% further than the ICE, and 65% farther than the EV powered by natural gas, and an astonishing 220% further than the EV whose electricity comes from renewables. That last line is what I think people have been really pinning a lot of hope on, is that we're going to have EVs powered by renewables, and you say that's actually the laggard in this story by a long shot. Take us through this thinking, would you? This is good stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So this expands on some work that we had done with EVs back in the day. And you know, if you go all the way back 10 plus years ago, Lee and I had to make the decision whether we wanted to become big EV investors and renewable investors, for that matter, or stick with, you know, more traditional forms of energy. And then nuclear, of course, is the silver bullet, because it creates the, typically people think of, you know, efficient and dirty oil, or less efficient and clean, and how you trade those two off. And it's a moot point, because uranium is clean and hyper efficient, right? Yes. So it obviates the whole question. But leaving that aside, you know, we had to decide what framework we wanted to compare EVs to internal combustion engines or renewables to traditional forms of energy. And we settled on this idea of energy efficiency, or EROI. I said, look, energy ultimately is such an abstract concept. No one actually, you know, feels, looks at, they just use energy. So, mm-hmm. So it's a tool in our daily life that goes completely behind the scenes. And, you know, it's not branded. No one cares what, you know, what company you get your energy from. It just all kind of is consumed. So what matters in that case is the efficiency of it. You know, how much energy goes in versus how much comes out. If what you need, if the scarce good is the energy that you use, mm-hmm. then clearly a key determinant is going to be how much energy is used to produce that energy itself. And that becomes known as the energy return on investment. You put energy in, you get energy out. Now, I want to make a distinction here, because there's almost two different phases of the world. One is when we have lots of cheap, abundant energy. In that case, the energy that gets consumed to produce the energy, the next incremental unit of energy, it's almost, you think of it like a margin, right? It's like, what's your gross margin versus your net margin? How much gets consumed along the way? And that's fine, and people care less about it. When energy itself becomes tight, it becomes more like capital. And you start to think, okay, like, what are your terms of payment? How quickly can I get my receivables back, right? You need as much energy as you can get. You start off with a small amount of scarce energy, and you want to create as much as you can from the end of that. What matters then is the recycle rate. You put it in, how much does that grow to on the way out? So there are almost two distinct phases of the economy. And we're transitioning from one phase where we've had ample energy, mainly because of the shales in the last 15 years, to a tighter market where we need to think much more about each scarce molecule or kilowatt hour of power. And so in that world, you start to say, okay, you start with scarce energy at the outset, you invest that into an energy system, you get an uplift. Even renewables create more energy than they consume. So you do get an uplift, but it's far less. Then you take that new amount of output energy, you put it into either gasoline in your internal combustion engine, or you put it into an electric vehicle, including the battery and the power lines and all this stuff. You try to account for as much of it as you can. You convert that into forward motion, and you say, fine, you start with 100 kilowatt hours. How far down the road do you get? And you just don't get very far with renewables. You get farther if you use an EV powered by gas, natural gas, because natural gas is a better upstream source than renewables, right? So that makes sense. But the most by far ends up internal combustion engines. They just go farther. People have all these false narratives around EVs where they only look at the automobile itself and they look at the efficiency of the electric motor versus the internal combustion engine. But it's meaningless, because it's just one part of the entire value chain of getting that car to market, and then of creating the power. I won't get into too much detail, but when you burn hydrocarbons, 70% of the energy contained in the chemical bond of that hydrocarbon is wasted as radiant heat. And 30% gets captured into forward momentum. And there's actually, you know, physics equations that say what the maximum efficiency that you could harness out of a hydrocarbon would be. It's whatever, 32, 34%. And that's basically where gas turbines run. But most of it's lost. Electricity, once you have electricity and you have electrons moving down a wire and you run that through a motor, that's very, very, very efficient. But it was very inefficient generating the electricity itself. So if you burn gas, natural gas, in a turbine, you're losing 70% of the energy there. And what you get is pure electricity, and the energy efficiency of the automobile is then 99%, 96%. If you burn gasoline in a car, that what was happening and not being counted upstream in the power plant is now happening in the car itself and being counted. So people say, oh, it's only, you know, 30% efficient versus 95% efficient, so the EV must be better. And that's complete nonsense. Sorry, I'm digressing. So where do hybrids fit into all this then? Well, hybrids are just, in my mind, a very, very smart and sensible way to create an internal combustion engine. And I'm talking about a traditional hybrid, not a plug-in hybrid, which tries to be both things. And it mm-hmm. has typically a 10 to 15 kilowatt hour battery, about, you know, tenth the size of a straight EV. And it has a gas tank and it uses both together. I'm talking more about what would be a traditional hybrid, which is purely gas with a very, very, very small battery, oftentimes not even lithium ion, which serves to capture the wasted energy that the car uses as it's gliding forward. So basically, you accelerate and you use the gas engine and you're converting all that chemical energy into forward motion. And then you got to slow down at a red light. And all of that gets wasted as heat. It gets wasted as heat in the friction on your brake pad. And it just gets radiated out into the atmosphere. And with a hybrid, what you do is as the car starts to brake, it actually spins a dynamo and it charges a battery and it captures all of that energy. And then when you go to start the car off of the line, it uses that in the most efficient form possible, which is to drive an electric motor when the car is fully stopped and the torque of an internal combustion engine is not optimal. That's fabulous. Fabulous. It captures, it's the closest you're going to get to a free lunch. It captures energy that you were otherwise just throwing away. It doesn't require a huge battery, which is very costly and environmentally degradacious to produce. It doesn't require renewable energy upstream, which is very inefficient. It just seriously is collecting all of that energy that you would otherwise literally just waste in friction. And that makes it very, very efficient. And I think it's so fabulous. You know, you look at hybrids, you know, before EVs became all the rage, hybrids took off like crazy and they never had any incentives. Never. You know, the taxi fleets in New York all went hybrid. It wasn't because they were being told to. It's because there was a really good car to get a cheap way to get better fuel efficiency. You get fantastic fuel efficiency through a hybrid. And to this day, hybrid sales are off the charts. They often get clumped in with EV sales. You put hybrids, plug-in hybrids and EVs now all get clumped in together as electric. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the hybrids are really what's driving a lot of that, particularly outside of China. And they're mostly doing it unsubsidized because they just make sense.
I love that idea because, you know, we just saw two failed wind block auctions in Germany, right? But the point was they pulled their subsidies. Now, 23 years they've been doing this and they've pulled the subsidies and the industry says we can't make it, which tells you it's not really an industry yet, right? The economics just don't pencil out yet.
No, of course. And England went through the same thing about 12 months ago. And, you know, there was an argument that the subsidies, you know, that I think literally the same day a report came out that said that UK wind was by far the cheapest unit of power, which by extension should mean it would have the highest margin in the entire country by a wide, wide, wide factor. And then they put three or four blocks up and they went zero bid. They didn't even like fail to clear that. No one bid on them because the subsidy scheme wasn't set. You know, it was in flux. And so everyone said, well, I'm just not going to bid. And it was a bit of egg on the face, I think, in for the UK, because, you know, how do you make this claim that this is by far the cheapest market-based product and nobody wants it unless you pay them to take it? Those two things don't really work together. And, you know, there's been lots of talk about how you need to encourage and incentivize energy transitions because of this huge ingrained infrastructure, you know, that exists for traditional energy and that, you know, you need anytime you have something that's clearly better, but nascent, network effects mean that you need to give it the push to get it started. And that's complete bunk. You know, every energy transition that's happened in human history has happened without government intervention. And it's happened relatively quickly. You know, if you look at how fast automobiles displaced horse and carriage, it was quick, you know, and that was a crazy revolution. We didn't have roads, you know, mm-hmm. and yet automobiles displaced horse and carriage relatively quickly. Even more quickly was when, you know, the jet age spawned and the Boeing 707 was really put into commercial use. You know, the passenger traffic across the Atlantic by plane instead of by steamship in 10 years, I think it was like 85% in 10 years. You know, we've been looking at Tesla for what, 20 years now? You know, and they're the biggest EV producer in the world and on and on and on. They still hardly can make any money without their, you know, tax credits in California and whatnot. So at what point do these things start to work? And the answer is they don't. The physics don't work on them. I wish they did. Mm. It would have made my life as an investor a lot easier. You know, I'm all in favor of technologies, which is why we like hybrids. But it's just some of these things just don't work. And the idea of lugging around a 100 kilowatt hour battery that has so much embedded energy in it and is so heavy for the days when you might want to go 350 miles. But then realistically, when you do that, you kind of take your wife's SUV anyway, or whatever your second car is, right?
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. It's a terrible, terrible way to do it. It's complicated. I get it. But there are people out there that should know better and policymakers that should know better.
Well, I've been waiting for this interview because I hope you have a position on this. One of my favorite substances, you did mention silver 6 times in the most recent quarterly report. I've been a huge fan of silver for a long time. But this announcement, and of course, you know, I hear battery announcements come out, Adam, like every week, and people say this is going to change everything, solid state, this, that. But Samsung really made a splash. They get, okay, silver is a solid state battery. We've already had silver batteries, obviously, you know, silver zinc, silver magnesium, that they use mostly military applications because very high energy density, but kind of expensive. So here they're giving you one of those mythical 100 kilowatt hour vehicle battery packs that you just sort of said doesn't really work. But using that, I wonder if you have a point of view on this battery, you know, yet. But, you know, obviously they do something stupid. They say if just 20% of the 16 million EVs, which is probably includes EVs plus what you're mentioning, the hybrids, silver demand would increase by 16,000 metric tons, which is 62% of current mine output. Obviously, that's not going to happen. You know, so A, what do you think about the battery? And B, you know, every time I look around the world to see how much silver is going to come out of the ground this year compared to last year, less seems to be coming out of the ground. And then China alone, their TOPCon solar panels, which are now just eating up because they're very efficient, uses 2x the silver of legacy designs. That green bar on the bottom down there, by eyeball, that's like 30% of global silver production by 2027. And China's total production at this year, they're thinking industry is going to be 12,566 tons. That's 48% of mine output. I'm just seeing a silver problem here from a supply-demand standpoint. But adding all that up, first, what's your view on the battery?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We've had some experience investing in the battery sectors, and we don't do it in the fund. We tend to raise some SPV money on the outside because, you know, it's more akin to venture capital than it is to the type of stuff that we're looking at, you know, for investors. I think the risk parameters are all different, and I think that they tend to be private. So we don't own them in the fund, but we do have some at times, you have some special purpose vehicles to invest in them. And, you know, it's definitely humbled me. The battery industry is fiendishly difficult. It's mm-hmm. extremely, extremely challenging to, you know, it's very easy to make a battery cycle electrons. It's very difficult to make a battery work commercially and operationally with parameters that make it make sense. And lithium ion was advanced in, you know, all the way back in the early 1990s. I mean, it was advanced before that, but commercialized in the early 1990s. And that was really kind of the latest real change in how we think of battery chemistry. And, you know, there are some real challenges to lithium ion battery that still exist to this day. Mainly, they tend to catch fire, and those fires can be really nasty. Frankly, we have not addressed that as a industry and as a society. We just sort of have learned to tolerate it, which is a bit insane when you really think about it. But batteries are hard. It's really, really hard work. So everything that I see, I treat with a very, very big proverbial grain of salt. And then, you know, and I've also seen companies that have had what I would have thought to be the best chance, real technology, real teams, big dollars being put into it, and that have failed for, you know, just commerciality reasons, not even reasons related to the technology. So it's just a fiendishly difficult business, and it's one that is filled with false boasts and claims, and color me skeptical. So, you know, as far as the silver solid state battery in particular, I know exactly who I plan to talk to about that. I have not done that yet. But again, we can leave that for the next one if you want to discuss that battery in particular. I know what he's going to say. I just don't know what rationale he's going to give me for why he's going to say it.
And then what about, I mean, the solar panel industry, very mature. Obviously, China's cranking them out. And that Topcon is a real silver pig, in a good way for a silver investor. But mine output has not been keeping up with what I consider to be one of the most profound structural supply-demand shortfalls that I can see. This will be 7 years in a row where world output is not keeping up with demand, and they're having to eat into supplies. It's crazy.
I think that a silver investor will be rewarded over time, for sure. We prefer gold in our precious metals basket right now. You know, could you make a case for silver as a complete distinct investment apart from gold, kind of like how PGMs is really predicated on hybrids and not so much on being a precious metal? Yeah, I think you can. Have we done that? No. You know, we tend to think of gold and silver together for better or worse in our precious metals basket, and we do tend to be a little more focused on gold. The reason for that is that historically, gold has outperformed and outperformed and outperformed, and then silver's caught up towards the tail end of those rallies, typically on a retail push. And, you know, lots of people have been doing this. Lee's been doing it 35 years. I've been doing it 20 years. And throughout, people have told me why silver is like changing its fundamental role. You know, the idea at the beginning was that, you know, film was giving way to digital cameras, and so no one was going to need silver anymore. It wasn't going to be industrial. Then it was, okay, silver is going to be hyper-industrial because of all the renewables and everything, and then it kind of goes back and forth and back and forth. I think the truth of the matter is that silver is silver. It has a lot of elements that are a lot of characteristics that make it similar to gold, from a monetary, quasi-monetary perspective. And then I think it has a lot of electrochemical elements and factors that make it a very good, albeit expensive, industrial metal. And so I don't think that they will keep coming up with uses for silver, because it's very conductive. It's more expensive than copper. Copper's another really good one. Less good than silver in conductivity, but a lot cheaper, right? And so they kind of... So, yeah, I think the outlook for silver looks good. And I think that, like you said, mine supply is tight. I think the outlook for gold looks good, and we remain gold bulls. And on the margin between those two metals, we're slightly more inclined on the gold side, just because we think this market has room to run. And historically, silver's been a little later cycle in the precious metals. But if you want to own it and you want to hold it through the cycle and you want to look at the trends in place now, I think they all look good, and I don't think you'll be disappointed at all.
We had questions last time, Adam, about your fund, and I pulled this off your website. I have to say a disclaimer that I'm neither promoting nor not promoting, and that past performance is no guarantee of future performance. But your GRHAX, here are the returns off of that: 1 month, 3 month, year to date, and 1 year. Year to date, 22%. What do you invest? What's in that vehicle for people in that mutual fund?
Yeah, sure. No, I'm happy to talk about that. That performance, I mean, I'm looking at the screen now. I said, if you pulled that off our website, then that's off our website. It's all good. Those numbers are, I believe, are correct.
As of 6/30/2025.
Yeah, so. That's right.
Yep.
What's in our portfolio? So we invest in listed resources equities. We invest across the spectrum. We invest in first looking at the top down. So we like to look sector by sector, kind of like the discussions that we're having here, these themes that we start to really like. Because realistically, how do you make money investing in commodity stocks? You better get the commodity price right. I suppose you could try to make money being completely agnostic on the commodity price. That's pretty difficult. 9 times out of 10, what you do is you get the commodity price right. You underwrite a different price deck than the market. The market thinks oil is going to stay at 50. You think it's going to go to 80. You pick the names that give you the best exposure to that move while managing for risk. That's what we like to do. The main sectors and themes that we have on right now, we have uranium. We have U.S. natural gas, unsurprisingly, crude oil and gold miners. And we have secondary positions in copper, ag, and a little bit of coal. As far as, you know, performance this year, it's been good. It's been broadening out too. The first quarter was really driven by gold stocks, and gold stocks were obviously big outperformers. And then in the second quarter, that broadened out. Gold did well also. PGMs really started to kick in, as you showed in the chart earlier. And then our uranium stocks came alive again. And I think that that's the trend that's going to continue. I think that the hedge funds have been shorting the hell out of the uranium stocks for most of 24 and the beginning part of 25. And they exhausted themselves and they ran to cover a little bit. And that helped propel performance of the uranium book in the second quarter. So I think the hedge funds are more neutral, a little bit more on the sidelines, and the fundamentals in uranium will now come to the fore, or back to the fore. They won't be as muddied by some of this hedge fund chatter, both on the bullish side in 2023 and then on the bearish side in 24. And we're happy. You know, the areas that have not really been doing so much have been more on the oil and gas side of things. And so I suspect that going forward, you know, I hope that, those will be two parts of the portfolio that I would hope will begin to contribute as well.
On the uranium side, is it for the uranium itself, or anything to do with, like, say, Okla, NuScale, any of the SMR builders? Are you on that side of the story too?
Well, I know an awful lot about that side of the story. We've chosen not to invest in that side of the story for the time being. And So first of all, I think everyone's been impressed with how Oklo in particular, you know, how that stock has performed. I have a hard time getting my arms around the valuation on that company today, although I know the technology very well. And in general, you know, molten sodium fast reactors, which is what both Bill Gates' TerraPower, which remains private, and Oklo are advancing, I think that's the winning design. I think realistically, TerraPower is probably put a lot more R&D money and a lot more time into advancing its reactor than Oklo has. And Oklo is taking a little bit more of an aggressive permitting approach than TerraPower is. And I won't get into all the details. There's two ways to approach permitting. They're taking the one that could move faster, but realistically is maybe considered a little more aggressive. That's all well and good, but at the valuation that it's at now, it gives me a little bit of pause as a value investor, for sure. If it pulled back dramatically, would we take a punt on something like that? I think it's possible, for sure. But at these prices, it just seems difficult. It seems difficult for a company that's not going to have revenue for a number of years. It's hard to get a DCF that gets you there. So I continue to think that for the time being, anyway, the number one way to get exposure to the uranium cycle, to the nuclear power cycle, is through uranium. You know, the price of uranium is still just not even there yet, really getting to the point that incentivizes new mines to come online, to say nothing of, you know, it's eventually going to get to a point where it's going to create a mania. So much money is going to come in, and you're going to overwhelm, you know, the market with too much new supply that comes online. That will end the bull market, but we're so far from that. We don't even have a price that incentivizes a new mine to come online. So I think that the best way to kind of take a step back, be a little bit more agnostic on what SMR technology goes forward, although I do have my favorites that I like, given the pricing and the supply demand dynamics, is just to own the uranium at this point and then revisit it as things progress.
Well, fantastic. Adam, thank you so much for your time today. Again, help people direct back to where they should go to find more.
Yeah, please. Our website, Go Rosen, Gehring and Rosenzweig, the name of the firm. And, you know, we put all of our research on our website. We love to come on shows like this. We do fewer of them than we used to, but with the people that we like to. And so Chris, certainly one of those. And, you know, find our stuff on YouTube and Twitter and all over. But Gehring and Rosenzweig is the firm, and GoRosen.com is the website.
Adam, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.